Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Jan Desper-Peters, your host of the BTST Services Podcast, Meeting You Where You Are. Meeting You Where You Are is a movement where we share factual and relevant information on real life issues that may affect your social, physical, and emotional wellness. Our guests are subject matter experts and people with real life experiences, sharing their lived experiences on the topic of the day. Though the topic may not resonate with you where you are today, I am confident that the nuggets that you'll hear dropped will be tools that you may use in the future to transform, empower, and inspire. Before Taraji P. Henson, Octavia Spencer, and Janelle Monáe portrayed the three famous mathematicians in Hidden Figures, Margot Lee Shetterly had written a book of the same name, chronicling the lives of mathematician Katherine Johnson, NASA supervisor Dorothy Vaughan, and NASA engineer Mary Jackson. I don't know about you, but until I saw that movie, I had never heard of these three extraordinary women who were pivotal in this country's quest to have a man on the moon. I also had never experienced a Black female professor until someone kind of dropped some knowledge on me that there were great professors in the African American Studies Department at the University of Maryland. I was a journalism major, and in the early 80s, there were no Black professors, male or female, in the journalism department. And so I was enamored by Dr. Sharon Harley, who was my first Black female professor. And so today, I have four extraordinary women as my guest, and they are all university professors. And I'd like to introduce them to you. I'm excited about this. I want to tell you why, because it wasn't difficult for me to find them, but it is difficult to find them. So I'll let you sit with that for a minute. It wasn't difficult for me to find them because I know them. They're my friends. I've known Dr. Jocelyn DeVance Taliaferro probably for 20 years and or more, right? And I'm just excited that she's here today. She's an associate professor in the North Carolina State University School of Social Work. Dr. Taliaferro's current research interests include nonprofit lobbying and teaching using contemporary television. Her work appears in the Journal of Child and Family Social Work, the Journal of Policy Practice, Administration in Social Work and Education and Urban Society. She recently completed a book on teaching social policy. Check that out. I said a book, right? A textbook on social policy using the HBO special, The Wire. In addition to her work in academia, she has spent more than 25 years in the field of social work and nonprofit administration, which included middle and senior management positions. Dr. Taliaferro has been an active member on several nonprofit boards of directors in Washington, D.C., Maryland, Delaware, and North Carolina. She has been teaching face-to-face, online, and hybrid courses since 2003. Dr. Taliaferro. Dr. Tracy Murray. Dr. Tracy Murray is the Dean of the College of Health Professions at Coppin State University. Dr. Murray's leadership experience extends to the local and statewide regions and beyond. She is a health commissioner on the Baltimore Commission on Aging and Retirement Education, a member of the Nurse Leadership Institute Council, Advisory Council, and a member of the Maryland Regional Action Committee. Dr. Murray has served on a number of boards, has published prolifically, and recently was elected to a two-year term on the American Association of Colleges of Nursing Nominating Committee. Dr. Murray. Dr. Tiffany Parkman is a lecturer and director of the undergraduate program in human Services Administration within the College of Public Affairs at the University of Baltimore. Dr. Parkman's research agenda focuses broadly on family interactions, mental health, and familial incarceration effects using both qualitative and quantitative methods. Additionally, her work is informed by over 20 years of experience working as a clinician, a community advocate, and program facilitator. When not in the classroom preparing for the next generation of social change leaders, Dr. Parkman works with various community organizations and nonprofits to evaluate their community programs and their programs' impact on families and community, and is a court-appointed special advocate volunteer for Baltimore City. Dr. Kimberly Flagg Sellers is a professor of mathematics and statistics, specializing in statistics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. She is a leading expert in generalized statistical methods involving count data that contains data dispersion with applications in numerous areas of statistical methodology. Professor Sellers was recently honored as an elected member of the International Statistical Institute in 2018 and is an active contributor to the efforts to diversify the fields of mathematical and statistical sciences, both with respect to gender and race and ethnicity. So those bios, I've shortened them. I'm sure you can realize that. And if you're listening, I don't have to tell you that I have four bad sisters today. And so I'm just, again, excited. And I always start out, especially in this season of COVID, just asking, how are you all doing in the midst of a worldwide pandemic? How are you doing today?
Making it. Taking every day one at a time.
One day at a time.
When yes. It feels like the same day at a time, yes.
Right. Almost like I described it one time as the Groundhog Day, if you remember that movie. It's like you wake up and it's like, sometimes I don't even know what day it is. It's like, is this Thursday? No, I think this is Saturday.
Very challenging.
Yes, very challenging. So I just wanted to ask you all to... What was your immediate pivot when in March you found out that you were going strictly to online instruction? What did that look like for you, and what did that look like for your university?
Well, this is Tracy. So when we pivoted, which we really didn't fully pivot because we have nursing programs and also allied health, and we still kept a footprint on the campus. So we never, and I'm a director of health centers, two health centers. We never really fully left the campus at all. So we've continuously thought about health and keeping health at the forefront. And I think it was just a gradual process. I think that we did not realize we went away for spring break. So we did not realize that when we saw each other previously, that was the last time we were going to physically see some people. And I haven't seen some people since then physically. And presence. So I think it was so gradual and so subtle that we, when we came back from spring break, people were still a little bit in shock about the fact that they weren't coming back to campus. We had some smaller footprint for activities we had to have, especially testing and some other components, library services and essential activities. But it's really a shock to not see your colleagues physically and not get physical touch in some of those components. And the gradual fade away has been quite interesting.
I'm sure that was very difficult if you especially were a senior. And there are, Dr. Murray, also not only a professor, but the dean of the College of Health Professions, which houses the college and School of Nursing. And so I know that there are very ceremonial activities that happen as almost a transition, a rites of passage, if you will, when you graduate from the School of Nursing. And so how was that handled with regard to some of those rituals and practices as people were preparing to leave Coppin?
So we did those remotely. We actually had a remote ceremony for health information management students and also our nursing students. We had their pinning ceremony remotely. We highlighted each student with a picture. We had the students who we would give awards to actually, they did video, pre-recorded videos. It was quite interesting. So it was our first virtual ceremony, but we also realized we really captured the uniqueness of this period. And we said it's 2020, which 2020 is perfect vision. And that's right. How we really highlighted them.
Okay, that was great and very creative. Now, Dr. Sellers, I just want to say that you were my impetus for this particular podcast because you are my soror. And I saw your announcement on Facebook that you had just acquired tenure. And so I was so proud of you. And so can you share with us your journey, if you will, as it relates to what that means for those who are listening to be a tenured professor?
Sure. So when I attained tenure status as an associate professor, that's the first level of promotion, moving from an assistant professor to an associate. And with acquiring tenure, a lot of people like to think of it as, you know, job security for life. Of course, there's some nuance to that, but in a lot of ways, yes, there is some measure of job security such that I have more of an ability and a flexibility to pursue research interests that are of interest to me, that I can likewise see, you know, a larger goal. And then more recently, actually, what I think you're probably referring to is that I was recently promoted from associate to full professor.
Okay.
So that's the next level of promotion, which is the highest ranking measure of professorship.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So fortunately, those research pursuits that I continued after attaining tenure, have paid off.
So Jocelyn, Dr. Taliaferro, would you share with us, I mean, because to move up that ladder that Kim just described, I know that you have to publish. I have friends that have taken sabbaticals and struggled with that publishing piece and that writing piece. So tell us what it was like for you. I mean, I read that you just published a new piece. And so tell us what it was like for you and your journey in publishing that piece.
Well, I started that process in 2003. I got tenure in 2009. And it was a lot. I was talking to a friend and they, you know, said, you know, because they wanted to go somewhere. And I was like, well, you know, I'm still working. And they were like, when are you done? And I was like, no, I'm never done. I just stop. So it's kind of that. That's probably the best way to explain kind of how you feel when you're getting tenure. You're always writing. And I had a colleague who was a mentor tell me kind of always kind of have something in the pipeline. So kind of had this transition of something that you're collecting data for, something that you're writing an IRB for, something that you're collecting data for, something that you're doing data analysis for, something that's under review, and, you know, kind of keeping that constantly going on multiple projects, and that ultimately will get you where you're trying to go. I'm trying to be like Dr. Sellers in the next 2 years and become full, so I'm still on that wheel. But I do have a lot more leeway in what I get to do and the projects that I choose and the things that I get to spend my time on. Like most assistant professors can't really do a book and work on how to use the wire for teaching. You know, that's a little bit more out of the box. And so I couldn't really do that until I got tenure because it was something I wanted to do and it really has worked out really well.
So Dr. Parkman, I wanted to ask you to share your journey as well. But when I met you because I was at a nonprofit organization and there was a young lady who was at the University of Baltimore who was going to be my intern. And you were the person who was responsible for those interns and placement. And so I'd just like for you to share, if you would, the importance or the impact that you all, you specifically, but you know, the collective would have on students who are you know, matriculating through either predominantly white institutions or HBCUs, and what you feel your obligation is to those students.
Okay. So I will start off by saying I became a professor by accident. It was not my desire to work at a university. I'm a clinician by heart, and I just recall, you know, being at the University of Kentucky working on my master's in marriage and family therapy, and then being at Virginia Tech working on my PhD in human development, and I'm seeing all these professors whose job is literally to research families and children, marriages and, you know, divorce and what works and what doesn't. And none of those people were happy. And so the stress and tenure and the review, like it, that totally freaked me out. And so when I was at Virginia Tech, I remember my advisor, you know, they would joke and say, you know, Tiffany doesn't want to be in the ivory tower. She wants to be in the trenches. And that was sort of this running joke because I wanted to, you know, I came into a PhD program from working in a prison. And so, like, I love being in the community. And so when I graduated, I really was going to go back to do clinical work. But then I found the University of Baltimore and the work that they were doing in terms of taking people who were clinicians and helping the helping leaders to do what they wanted to do in terms of bettering their community. And I felt like it was a good fit. But it amazes me in terms of, you know, being in my position, students, you know, students who haven't had someone who looks like me. So I went to an HBCU. So all I know is Black professors. Like that's where I came from. Like that's, you know, you attend an HBCU, it's a family. And so when I got to the University of Kentucky for my master's, I remember when I went to Lexington and looked around and I saw a Black face and said, excuse me. Well, where were the Black people? And they were like, oh, and it was summer. And they were like, oh, they'll be back in the fall. Like, really? And so it took me a while just to adjust. And then, you know, the only Black people really that you see are the basketball team. And then when I got to Virginia Tech, again, where are the Black people? And so Virginia Tech is the largest public university in the state of Virginia and has the least amount of Black people. So I think maybe 500 graduate students, a school of 26,000. So if you want to see a Black person, you know, you got to look in the mirror some days. And I remember the first time I was teaching a class, I walked in and there were 5 Black students in the class and they looked like they saw a ghost. And it was the first day. And, you know, I'm doing the syllabus and I'm going over the requirements. And I get to the end and I say, any questions? And one lone Black student raised her hand and said, can you tell me what products you use for your hair? And I was like, I said, you see me after class? You know, because here all the white students are like, what? And it's like 50 people. And they're like, you know, but they didn't get it. You know, and at that moment, the impact of seeing someone in my space, it wasn't just about what I was teaching or what I was going to see. But this is someone who looks like me, who has a life maybe like mine, and potentially I could be that person. And so that helped me to be more agreeable to having a life in academia.
So that's interesting. Interesting that you said that I'd like to drill down on, and that was that, you know, that you're a clinician at heart. I know Jocelyn, she is a social worker at heart. I know Tracy, she's a nurse at heart. And Kim, you know, mathematics is your thing, and I'm sure that teaching math and statistics is your passion. So I'm going to assume, and I could be wrong, that when you were 6 or 7 years old and someone said, Tiffany just said, no, that was not her deal. She didn't think that that was where she was going to go. What do you want to be when you grow up? You said, I want to be a tenured university professor. And so what was that transition like for you? And I know that I've spoken to Tracy many times, and she shared with me sort of her connection with her family and her parents, and how, you know, it was important that she be in a helping profession. And so if you could share a little bit of that story, Tracy, it would be great.
Well, you know, when I think about like being younger, and look where I'm at right now, and especially being a nurse, I think so much of my grandmothers and how they really took me during the summer, and we were visiting with the sick and the shut-in, and we did so much in the community from going to their different organizations and helping others and helping my grandmother. I watched her help young women. And so that probably laid the seed. My aunt was a nurse, and my uncle was in like insurance related, but I saw them going to the hospital as well. So that really guided that process. But I know certainly when I was in school, I was in areas where, and I was telling my daughter the other day, faculty members or my teachers at the point in time who were like math and they just loved it. And so they laid that seed for that. And then one of my teachers who said, you know, you're going to participate in the science fair, even though I didn't want to participate in science fair. So he laid a seed for science and the love of science. And then somebody else for like government. But the energy that they created like helped to lay foundation as well to anchor me. And I think when I was in 12th grade, I knew I wanted to go to university and study, but my dad and I would only apply to one school only, and I'm glad I got into that particular program. But it seems like it's a natural gravitation to have landed in this space. When I moved from Florida to come up to this area, there was an individual who had I worked with, and she told me to continue. She saw something in me as far as for not the clinician. I was just doing some part-time work as a nurse educator, as an adjunct faculty member. And she said, when you go to DC area, you know, go to Howard University, get a job there. You know, but she saw that in me. And I thank her for that, Dr. Labadie, because she really laid that seed, because I may not have connected the dots naturally. But when I think back, even when I used to teach in Vacation Bible School, the natural intersection between education and healthcare has always been there from my childhood, and it's worked very well.
Thank you.
I have just a quick thing. You said that, you know, most of us didn't, you know, at such a young age say, this is what I want to be. But I distinctly remember when I was 12 years old, I came downstairs into my parents' kitchen, and I said, I decided I want to be a doctor. And my parents were like, okay, whatever. And I said, no, not that kind of doctor. I want to be a PhD doctor. And I said, I'm not sure on what, but I'm going back upstairs. I don't know. I'll figure it out later. And literally walked upstairs. They were like, who is this child?
And I believe that about you.
exactly. And then to add to that, my grandfather, my family grew up. My grandfather has 7 children. He has a 3rd grade education. My grandmother has a 6th grade. He has had a 6th grade education. She never worked a day outside the home in her life, and she just raised her 7 children. My grandfather put all 7 of his children through college. Most of them went to Morgan State University. When we were young, we all lived within about 3 blocks of each other, literally. And so we used to always come over to his house. And the way his chair sat, anybody who came through the door, he would be able to see him. Every time we went over there, we got a speech, and it was called the Be Somebody speech. And I'll make it real quick because it's like a 12-minute speech that you got every time you went over there. But the speech said, be somebody. Grow up and be somebody. Get your education, girl. Get your education. Because they can take away your money. They can take away your house. But they can't take your education. And we heard that at least 3 times a week for my entire formative career. And so, like I said, he put all of his children through college. They put their children through college. And so that was just part of who we were. And we had the understanding that we were going to go as far with this thing as we possibly could. And that was kind of what put it there. I didn't know it at the time and didn't realize it for a long time afterward. But like Tracy said, kind of putting those dots together is what eventually happened to make me understand the importance of what was poured into me in that way.
I agree.
I really enjoyed watching you, Jocelyn, specifically because you and I work together. And I'm a little bit older than you. You just had a birthday. Happy birthday. And immediately upon our being introduced and working together, I knew that you were going to do even greater things, right? Feel like, you know, preaching right now, but,
but thank you.
Every time I heard about a milestone or accomplishment, I was never surprised, only happy that you were, you know, going to higher heights. And so I appreciate you telling that story about what motivated you. And so, Kim, you were going to say, you were going to share your motivation as well.
So I can associate with Jocelyn's experience in that, for me, the big pivotal point was, a lot of people find this shocking, it was third grade. So you figure that's around, what, 8 years old, somewhere around there. And so for me, third grade was pivotal for two reasons. One, I was in third grade for all of 2 months before being moved up to fourth grade. So I essentially skipped a grade. And then also I can remember at that time, truly realizing that I wanted to do something at least involving math as a career and to pursue a PhD. Now, people wonder, how could I know about a PhD at such a young age? Well, my father was actually a college professor growing up and dean of fine arts. He's in music. So that was one point of reference because I was exposed to the Howard University campus. I always joke that I'm a child of Howard University. Just always being on that campus, being raised in that environment was very enlightening. And then both of my parents had master's degrees. And no one in my family yet had a PhD. So in my mind, I wanted to be the first in the family. And so I essentially spent the next 20 years working toward that goal. I didn't know if it was exactly going to be in mathematics, but certainly something math related, just because that was my favorite subject. And then the third rationale behind pursuing it is that with my dad being in the college environment, he used to bring home issues of, there was a journal, Black Issues in Higher Education. Mm-hmm. And once a year, they would publish the numbers of African Americans that got their PhDs in certain disciplines. And so since math was my favorite subject, we would look up the numbers for math and the mathematical sciences. And they were always abysmal. So that too was a driving force because I was thinking, oh, well, I'm going to be one of those special people to, you know, be represented in the number. So I just held on to that throughout my schooling. Now, ironically, in terms of becoming a professor, looking back on it, the stars have somewhat aligned because education does run in my family. Like I said, my father was a professor and a college dean. My mom was a public school teacher, DC school teacher and administrator. So I have educators on both sides of my family there. And then my maternal grandfather was a high school STEM teacher. And my dad, actually, if he had not gone into music, he was considering mathematics himself. So in retrospect, it seems like everything just sort of aligned in me.
So Kim, just expand a little bit for me. We've been talking about what it means to be tenured, what it means to be a university professor, how and who motivated you to be on this track. But there had to have been some bumps. And if you could share one bump and how you kind of, you know, rolled along and kept it going, I think that would be helpful for people to hear.
Sure. So I'd say, I guess the most significant bump that I can think of was in graduate school. So to explain, I had completed my bachelor's at the University of Maryland, College Park, and had initially continued on in that program, actually as a PhD student. If you see my record, it reads that I got my master's from Maryland and then continued on to GW for my PhD. But what a lot of people don't know under that veil is that part of the reason that I moved on and transitioned from a master's to the PhD at another institution is honestly because I did not pass the qualifying exams at the University of Maryland. Most people would be shy in divulging that information, but I find a lot of power in it because it taught me a lot of life lessons. And certainly there's a lot of backstory to that. But in the end, I can, you know, take ownership in the fact that I did not pass the quals at that institution. And it taught me another level of preparation and study and how to strategize and organize for this continued pursuit. Also, it gave me a lot of newfound strength, because certainly there was that part to me that questioned, should I continue pursuing a PhD? I wasn't quite sure if it was in the cards for me, because obviously I'm being tested at this point. And in the end, I had to remind myself, I wanted a PhD in a math-related area. Never in that vision did I say that it had to come from the University of Maryland. Never did I say that it had to be in pure mathematics. So I just had to get over that sort of mind trap and figure out what was best for me. And recognizing at that point, because during that period at Maryland, that's actually when I really grew to enjoy statistics, as it turns out. Coming into graduate school, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do yet. And so recognizing this greater interest in statistics was really the driving force. And then, going on and closing out that chapter, in my life and applying for PhD programs in statistics.
Well, George Washington University is not too shabby. I said, George Washington University is not too shabby.
Exactly. You know, but that's the thing. I think people get this trap in their minds that everything is just supposed to work in succession, easily and smoothly. And so I'm open in telling this story, particularly because you'd be surprised how many people out there actually have had a similar experience to mine.
Right. And I appreciate your transparency. I really do appreciate your transparency, because sometimes, I've always believed that, we should allow our misery to be our ministry. And that, in saying that, is that if you can help someone to understand that they aren't the only person that has ever gone through X, then it can definitely help them along their journey as well. Now, Tiffany, can you share for us a bump that you may have encountered along the way as a university professor, and then how you overcame that?
So I actually want to sort of piggyback on what Kimberly said, because I think when we think about Black women who have PhDs or who've gone through that process, it's a special sisterhood, because people don't really get it, And I remember, my parents, my dad was in the military. He didn't go that, my parents didn't go to college. I have doctors and lawyers in my family, but nobody with a PhD. And so they just really didn't understand. And so after 2 years, they were like, well, are you finished? And says, no, that's not how this works. And then, after three, well, are you done? Like, well, hold on, And so, people who are not in the space of, master's to PhD don't get the process or the stress or the quals or, prelims or, defenses. They don't sort of get that. So you develop your own support network of people who are going through the process. And when things like that happen, juggling the politics of, it's really, I think, I think everybody's mentally ill, but there's a certain mental illness to someone who wants to get a PhD, because the things that we go through and we put ourselves through to get this degree is really taxing. And people, I don't think people quite get it unless they've actually been through the process. To Kimberly's point, we're all in it because we remember, what that was like and what happened and our struggles and and honestly, my situation was very similar to Kimberly's, where, I was at Virginia Tech and I had an advisor who You know, my work, I'm coming from a prison. My work is in incarceration and fatherhood. She's a fatherhood researcher. She's really the reason I came to Virginia Tech, because she was doing work in incarceration and fatherhood. And so here I have this white woman who, you know, is salivating because she's got this black, you know, this black girl who loves prisons, you know, which means now she don't have to go, right? She has a student who speaks the language, who comes from the community. So now all of her research is good because she has a graduate assistant or a research assistant who can go do the work. And right. So when you're in higher ed, you know, your moneymaker is on graduate students who pull the weight. And so when it came time for my preliminary examinations, you know, I selected my committee, I met with everyone, and she had not done her due diligence with the committee members to talk about Tiffany's interests and what this should look like and how the process should be aligned. And she was totally disjointed from it. And so I was carrying a lot of this weight. And so my statistics professor, our committee member, she was a statistician from Columbia. Like, that's all she did was numbers all day. But I'm a qualitative researcher. And so she wanted me to do multiple regression by hand on a chalkboard. And I'm like, nobody does that. Who does that? You know, and so my advisor was totally, totally like, well, you have to do it. And I'm thinking, is she giving me data sets? Like, how is this going to work? And so literally, we were in my defense, and I'm on the chalkboard doing mathematical equations, and the other committee members were looking like, what is she doing? Like, they couldn't even answer the question. And so the politics of being, of standing up for yourself and finding mentorship and people who can support you makes all of the difference. And so technically, I should have failed, and I guess I did fail my preliminary exam, but because my advisor flubbed a whole, I mean, she just, because she was so disconnected and she was worried about the wrong thing, not her student, me, but in what her student could do for her in terms of the research, they couldn't fail me. They had to give me another 6 months to redo my prelims and give me another opportunity. But I had a mentor who was at the university, and I call her my white grandmother. Actually, she called herself my white grandmother. And she was a full professor. She was, you know, former dean, former professor emeriti. And, you know, I went to her bawling and crying, like, what is happening? Because if you fail, you know, that is like time on your life. And she was like, Tiffany, it doesn't matter if you're wronged or if something happened to you, you always do the right thing. You just do the right thing. And basically what I thought she was saying is, don't go in there and cuss them out, or don't go in there and wild out, which is what they are expecting of you. And so I don't know what she did behind the scenes. I don't know what she did behind the scenes, but it all worked out. And I would say that is probably my biggest, you know, obstacle in terms of facing, you know, during this time is, again, you know, sort of piggybacking on what Kimberly said, is that qualifying exam and finding your place in a highly toxic and politicized environment where one person's dislike of you can derail years of work that you've put in at a school. So
that's a great transition, Jocelyn. You are at the University of North Carolina, and one of my best friends and her husband went to North Carolina State University. And I was actually talking to her this morning about how excited I was to do this podcast. And she said, you know, when I was at the University of North Carolina, I never had a black professor. and she's my age. So it was early 80s. And so I just want you to share with us, because we know, as Kimberly said, when she was a young student and they looked at the Journal of Black Higher Education, and the numbers, especially in her field, were always abysmal as it related to the number of people that were getting PhDs. But if you could just share with us any thoughts you have on, you know, what the racial and ethnic inequality looks like in your profession, and then how you've seen it change over the years.
Sure. I'm at NC State, and we're the one down the street from UNC.
Okay.
the red one. but Yes, it is. We have a very small population of African-American faculty. I think we have 1,500 faculty, and I can't remember the exact percentage of them that are African-American, but I do know that we're not a lot. I've had the experience of students in my class in social work, which is a female-dominated, and at this point, getting to be a very diverse discipline. But I've had some students come to my class who might have been from Western North Carolina and say, you're the first Black person I've actually spoken to in my life. Mm-hmm. And so that really
That's in 2020.
That is in 2020.
Wow.
And mm-hmm. that put in perspective kind of the weight that I have. And I talked to my mother, and Jan, you know my mother, and I'm always, you know, she's my confidant, you know. And I was telling her, I have to be really careful about what comes out of this mouth. Because sometimes this is all they're going to hear and understand and know from a Black person, you know? And so I can't do some of the off the cuff, you know, smart stuff that I do sometimes. So I have to be really cognizant of that. It is, in my department, I am so blessed to have, at one point, the department head, I was the director of the graduate program, the director of the undergraduate program, the director of field. We were all African-American women. And we joked because those are the four administrative positions in the department. And we joked because we said orientation, when we stood up to greet all the students, we knew they were like, wait, did we go to the wrong, is this the HBCU or the PWI, you know, because you know, that's very, very different in any department. My department is known for having the most diverse faculty and student population. And we did that very purposefully. We literally over-enrolled for African-American students and students of color. And so, but on the campus writ large, that is not the case.
Okay.
And it comes in the difficulty of it comes in, I'll give an example. I've met one of the same professors in another department who is a white man. I've met him about 5 times and he does not remember me. I've been there 17 years. This hair is, you're going to remember that, you know, off the cuff. You know what I mean? It's just like really? And every time he sees me, oh, it's so nice to meet you. And I finally started saying, no, we met here, 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 and here. And he's like, oh, I remember now. But it's that kind of little stuff that's exhausting,
right, right.
That comes with all of this. Mm-hmm. And it's not, I never have had anything overt. I've never had any, outwardly racialized experiences on our campus. But the microaggressions, get them in spades.
Okay.
Get them in spades.
Yeah. So Dr. Murray, you are currently at an HBCU, and I know that you primarily have African-American students, African-American faculty. And so can you just share with us some of the commitment and obligation you feel to make? I think it was maybe Tiffany that said that she went to an HBCU, so she felt that love. I attended University of Maryland with Kim, and then I went on to get my master's from George Washington University as well. So I've never attended as a student in HBCU, but both of my sons did. And so I feel the love at the HBCU when I take them there. And so I just want you to share, because I believe that you've had experience on both sides. Just kind of share what your experience has been on both sides.
So thank you for the question. So certainly, I worked at University of Miami, and I know that really, I mean, you're unique based on your color being there, and of course, certainly with the Hispanic population being dominant down there, so it's an even different culture. But then our students were white students dominantly. So, I mean, you have a high level of where they see you, like very much so what was mentioned previously about they see you, they look at you, you're like that example or exemplar that they're looking at. Maybe they've never encountered somebody who's been a person of color, and they don't recognize like how you talk and you're educated. And but we have to also juxtapose that to the images that are present in the media, and what people see most dominantly about us and what they encounter in television and whatever else. And that's all they know. So we are that exemplar, and we do unfortunately have to be the example, like the one model that they might see throughout. When I juxtapose that to think about, I worked at Howard University, and there's a different dynamic of people of color that go there. Many times their parents have already gone to or have a degree. So it's a little bit different dynamic, but very unique. And where I'm at currently at Coppin State University, we're still dealing with first generation individuals who are still getting their degrees, and their parents can't guide them. So I feel like I'm in a great position to, because I'm a mother, was a wife, and just certainly being a woman of color, that I want them to have the same type of experience that you encounter at a predominantly white institution, mm-hmm. with resources and everything that's available. And if our students can receive all the magnitude of every component that is available to them, would they succeed and thrive? The answer is absolutely yes. But through that, what I do realize is our students build resilience. In our absence sometimes of the same amounts of resources, other aspects, they're the most resilient individuals ever. And what I do hear about when they graduate is how committed they are, how anybody will hire.
Because of all that they can do.
Okay. All right.
So I'm glad to be able to be there at Coppin State University working with the students on a regular basis. But I think that we also have to talk about internal racism as well, that we sometimes encounter even among our own women of color, and how we might all look alike, but we sometimes don't even have a level of tightness among ourselves. I always anticipate some level of problem, potentially, of people in my opposite race. And I've been well prepared by being raised in the South and raised in Florida of what I'm going to encounter when I deal with people that are of my opposite race. But I have not necessarily, I don't think it's talked about enough, what we sometimes encounter among people in our own race and how we may not be of support fully of each other, and we don't even know why, as African-American women.
I think that's a great point. And as we come to a close, I just want to just reiterate that I can't remember exactly who said it, but we were talking about this sisterhood, this profession that you all are in is a special sisterhood. I mean, Tiffany and I and Kim, we're a sorors, and so we understand sisterhood. I know that Jocelyn's a Delta, she understands sisterhood. And Tracy is in various professional and fraternal organizations, understands sisterhood. And I appreciate that point in relationship to our making sure that we continue to be those women who support other Black women. And would encourage that, not necessarily of you all, because I would be preaching to the choir, but for those who are listening, that is so important that we support each other. And so as we come to a close, I just want to thank you all again for such a great conversation, and for allowing me to invite you to this space, meeting you where you are. I want to end with a quote. If there's a book that you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it. That's Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison also said, I tell my students, when you get these jobs that you have been so brilliantly trained for, just remember that your real job is that if you are free, you need to go back and free somebody else. If you have some power, then your job is to empower somebody else. This is not just a grab bag candy game. And that was from the great Toni Morrison. So I want to thank you all again for your time. I want you to know that I am so very proud of you. I'm so very proud to know you. I believe that we discussed, along our journeys as children, not even knowing someone who had a PhD or was a university professor or tenured or even what that means. And so I am so grateful that you transparently shared your journeys with us. And I know that it will transform, inspire, and empower someone along the way. So that's it for us today at Meeting You Where You Are. Please like, share, and subscribe on the Podomatic app, SoundCloud, or the Apple Podcast app. And until we meet again, peace, blessings, and stay safe. God bless you all.
Thank you.